Well, they come in and they just lined up just rows of them again, you see. Old Skoglund, who I know for many years, he was in the office. So I just walked up and I thought, well, I'll have a little chat with him. I said, well, Skogie, pretty damn good job the worker's done today, huh? He didn't even say hi, yes, or hello, congratulate me or anything. He threw his fist in my face. God damn you, Mabel, I want to give you to understand that don't you try to grab leadership of this union. God damn you, if you do, we're going to take care of you. I says, calm down, Skogie. Nobody's going to gain leadership in this union or steal leadership. I said, I'm not here for that purpose. I'm here to help the workers fight. And I said, that's what we're going to do. I said, don't worry so damn much about your damn leadership. But that's when it should have been taken. Uh-huh. I mean, you could have went in there with the workers, because they just went through a real fight out on your Minnesota Boulevard. That's after they came in to report on this, you see. And all of the real good scrappers was out there. They had been running, sent out some scouting cars. Word got out that they're going to run it. It was mainly doing it to provoke, you see, and to show that they could get through. And so they sent scout cars out there, and they had it pretty well figured out. I mean, it was even in the paper what time these trucks were going to come in and so on and so forth. But out there, there were several hundred workers, and there used to be woods out there. And, when they got out there, well, who the hell's in charge? Workers, 300 or 400 workers out there. Who's in charge? Look around. Ask me. I said, I don't know. Where the hell's your leadership? Not a soul out there, you see. Well, I said, you guys are in charge. I said, what the hell are you going to do? Come on over here, fellas. And they come over where we was. There was a couple of us there together. Come here. Here's a guy who can tell us what to do. Well, I says, I'm not trying to take leadership or anything like that, but the guy says, this is a serious situation. Why don't you come out here just for fun? I says, that's only going to show an awful weakness. I says, what you going to do? Well, I says, these are pretty damn big trucks. They're hard to stop. But I says, the first thing I would do, we're here in plenty of time, you see, get somebody that's got a good high-speed car that you can send out to meet them. You know, they come in from on Highway 12 out here. There's two roads you have to watch. There's the fork of a road way out here by Lake Minnetonka. And when they see these trucks coming, they watch. They go past him and they beat it right down here. And first, have one who really comes in and lets you know. And then the other one who just stays ahead of the truck. And we gave them all the strategy to you. Now, get the rest of them. We got plenty of them here. Christ, we got hundreds. They can go up there and take a hold of any one of them trees and just pull them right out of there, right by the roots. Go up there and get a hold of all the trees you can. Have them right down here beside the road. The cops didn't dare to come where it was. No. They didn't dare to come because the workers had already shown all that day that they were really militant. And have them here. And those trucks come, just load the highway with them. Logs, because you can't stop with the human body. And you have two cars. You have one, and when them trucks start coming, that he just comes hell-bent for election, never mind these speed laws, so that he can report they're coming. The next car just stays ahead of the trucks, and when he gets down here near us, he just keeps blinking his lights all the time like that. We know that's the car, and we know the next one back of him. Don't let any cars get between him and the truck. We know the next one back of him is the truck. And after you blink your up there for about a half a mile away, then that car just goes to beat hell, you see, and gets across here, and immediately them logs go across the road. What the hell's that truck going to do? Boy, it worked so just like a charm. Oh, Mr. Truck Gum Boy, and he rams into those logs. And when he rams into the logs down over the bank, his truck goes. The truck part stayed upright, but the trailer tipped over, and boy, talk about eggs. There they were, they captured the guys, you know, they had a little prison over in Strike Headquarters where they put them in, you see. They had a little jail of their own over there. So they grab all of these and they take them in. Well, they come back into Strike Headquarters, and of course the workers, they have to report. I told them, I says, now you want to elect your committee. So that everybody, and boy, they went back in there, and when that news got out what they had done with them trucks going in there, the other one stopped back there, but they captured him. He couldn't turn around, you know. There was two trucks running together. Very big ones, all full of eggs. Well, there was a lot of free eggs, let me tell you, out there. Truck drivers had, I mean, the people who was out there had eggs for a few days or a few weeks, maybe some of them. They carried them by the case. But anyhow, on every instance, and I asked Don right to his face. I debated him one time up to the workman's circle, it was up there. It was during election campaign, and that's one thing I threw into his face, about the great leadership there was. I said, I'll tell you now, Vince, honestly, will you tell these, and there was a lot of truck drivers there, will you tell these people one case that you was ever on a picket line? Were you ever living to workers? You never faced a policeman's club, and you know damn well you didn't. You sat in the office and you finagled how you could get control of it, that's all. And that's one reason why, this was shortly before they lost the union too, that's one reason why the workers haven't got enough confidence in you. You're not always going to be there. I told him that to his face. Mm-hmm. That was one thing I never
got. Truth,
yeah. Hell, I went up into their own headquarters when they were up on Plymouth Avenue. By permission, I mean, we talked with our people, should it go or not. They were going to expose. They were going to expose the Communist Party. They were going to expose the labor wreckers. And you know what the labor wreckers were? The labor wreckers were the ones that way back, and I began to tell you about how I formed new organizations, you see? They called that labor wrecking.
Oh.
So they were going to expose the labor wreckers. And that hall was crowded. I had one fellow with me, that's all. And of course they were noted at that time, if you got up and opened your mouth, you just got batted. But I just thought to myself, again, I had confidence in the workers, I don't think them babies are going to bat me. But after all, I know too many truck drivers too. And went up and said in about the fifth row. I sat there, they had everybody speaking up there, Bob Kramer and everybody else. Of course, Bob's very mild about it, you know. It was them that really wanted to create a vigilante situation where they could attack people, don't you see?
Mm-hmm.
I sat there, and many times when he would do this, I provoked him. I sat there and I'd laugh at him, at his statements, right in his face, and he was up in the mattering again. And finally, right towards the last of his speech, he got clear up the front and he leaned over. Yes, and God damn it, there's the main one. That Mabel. I just sat there and I laughed at him like this. And he sat there and he carried on a tirade against me. And there wasn't a soul, not even, and they had some bouncers in the back end, not a damn one of them come there, because he couldn't even get a bit of applause out of the thing. Yeah, he was calling me a labor wrecker, you know, and after all, I'd been in some struggles, the worker knew. So when he gets done, I get up and I says, well, Vince, I didn't know you could get that damn fiery up there. I said, the guy has to be pretty damn frantic when he talks like that, doesn't he? I says, you know every word that you said, Vince, was a goddamn lie, and you know it. And I says, the workers here know it too. And boy, you should hear them applause. You bet you. No anybody else had stood up to him, don't you know? I stood up there, and they applauded. Of course, they adjourned the meeting right away. Bang, meeting's adjourned. I stayed up there, I'll bet you, till pretty near 2 o'clock with those guys. And boy, I'll tell you, we really had quite a time up there that night.
With Dan, you mean?
Huh? Their hall. Oh, no, not with them. They disappeared, workers stayed, and I stayed with them.
Oh.
And we discussed the whole thing. We went over the whole history, the strikes, the struggles, and how this thing took place and that thing took place. You know, many things, took place. Well, again, what happened? When they got ready to close in on them, why, there was nothing. It was, as far as the labor movement, they were just wiped out like that, wasn't it?
Uh-huh.
There was a little bigger struggle. They wiped the left out, too. But they didn't wipe them out on the same basis as they did there. No, there was a big difference. Because there for a while, yes. Right after the strikes, because of the publicity, of their own publicity, there's one thing you got to give them credit for, boy. They are good publicity people. It was organized. Well, they said about for 5 days, the Central Labor Union's halls used to be over there on First Avenue North. For 5 days, it was all surrounded by police. It's true, there was some police there, but it took them 5 days to smuggle all these people into that hall to get ready for this big battle that was put up. See? Which is a damned lie. They themselves never dared come near that place, and they didn't come near it. But when the general call by the grapevine that mobilized the people around town, and mainly the guys that put up the fight again was the same ones that fought at the Flower City, that fought at Strutwire, and mainly was from 212 Hennepin. That was the only place publicly that there was anything really organized. There were thousands of people standing around down there, do you see? Mm-hmm. While they were loading these trucks to go out. Fruit trucks is what they were, and some meat trucks down there, do you see? Well, then what do you figure? You figure, first of all, those people will fight. They're not all there just out of curiosity, but they're not going to fight without leadership. And we had the leadership. And that was organized right down to the T, to where there was captains, main captains, captains under them. Each one had so many people, how they must go among the crowd. And the main thing that started the whole battle down there was a funny situation. We had a fellow who knew some of the wholesalers down there. Well, you know, they were, during that strike, while they had been tied up, there was a lot of eggs rotted down there. And of course, this guy knew it. And this fellow that runs this wholesale place, he's a little bit friendly. He's a little liberal. Still is, I think. I'll mention names, but we figured, now if them babies try to bust this up and make a charge, if them people has got some of these good overripe eggs, them cops ain't going to go too far. And boy, they brought them cases out. I don't know how many cases there was. We got a committee together to go and get them out. They went, took them out of the back door and took them out way around. They went down there, we bought 200 little paper sacks that would just conveniently hold about 3 to 4 eggs, you know. And we took those and we filled them. And you'd be surprised how those people, and everyone, it was just whispered to them, now hold them till you get the signal. Don't throw them until you get the signal. And surprising as it would be, there was never one fired. But this whole crowd was around there. I don't know how many hundreds or up in the thousands were there. And then a couple of hundred of these sacks of eggs around there. And some of them had rotten bananas and a few other things. But anyhow, when these cops started to make their flying wedge, you know, he come out and he had his mouth open. Get out! Get out! Get out! And kaplow, right? I never as good as Mark in my life. With as ripe an egg as he could, right square in the mouth. And he went, well, anything like that, you'd be surprised how a militant it'd make the workers. Well, through that air, we had the pictures in the paper, you know, and they had photographers there. That air was just full of eggs. And you never saw such a plastered up bunch. Well, then, of course, the workers charged. That was what was known as the Battle of Bull Run. They had all kinds of people deputized, including Dick Daniels, who was a former fighter, you know. They brought him out of the workhouse and told him, well, you go down there and act as deputy and we'll let you get out. He had stole some garments before that. These are the kind of people that he used. But I'll tell you, did they run? And the workers chased them up there. Some went through the Andrews Hotel, every way that they could get out of there. And boy, they just pasted them. Well, it was unfortunate. The guy got killed in there. In a way, it was, and still he was a deputy. I mean, he was a guy that was, they did a little shot a few times, but it got so damn hot, them eggs and tomatoes and bananas and things like that. They dropped their guns. Well, my God, I seen the workers they brought down to 212 there. There was a big long table in there. looked like an arsenal. They had helmets, they had badges, they had billy clubs. They gathered up the souvenirs. And I'll tell you, that place down there, you could walk around there and there wasn't a cop there for days. There wasn't a cop there for days. Well, you are going to pin your hopes. I mean, they're not people who want to give up hopes.
No.
But they just haven't got any confidence. So, in order to have anything out of life, you got to pin your hopes someplace. So where can you pin it? You can only pin it on the working class and its allies. Mm-hmm. In anything, you see. There's no other place, because the rest, outside the working class and its allies, are all against you. That's true. At this time, when they have their so-called prosperity, it isn't prosperous for everybody, but it's prosperous for so many more than it is during a depression time, you see, that you can't get organization today. Now, there is certain organizations that you could get today. But when the economic conditions change, now this has happened not only in the last depression, but it happened in many of those before. Going way back, I went to Arnold, Pennsylvania while I was blowing glass from Ohio. Things had got tough. I mean, the factory where I was had shut down, but of course it shut down to move to Clarksburg, West Virginia. That was the Pittsburgh Plate Glass Company. And in the meantime, I was acquainted with a fellow there, a little Italian fellow who had worked over in Pennsylvania in several of the American glass company's plants, and a very good worker. That is, he knew his business. It's all skilled trades in there, you know. And so he asked me, he said, would you go over to Pennsylvania with me if we can get a job over there? He had been working as a waiter. If the glass factory was shut down, you couldn't get a job at any place else. I had two other things that I tried to work at. You know, when I was a kid, I used to fire in the flour mills. I was a good stationary fireman. And I was a machinist. You couldn't get nothing. This was in 1913. Okay. Right over to Arnold, Pennsylvania, and right back he got a letter. Yeah, come on over. But they did, it wasn't liberal like they used to be. I mean, it used to be, or afterwards, when times got better, if you wrote and they give you a job, they always send you a ticket, either that or telegraphed you one, told you to go down to the depot, your transportation there. Mm-hmm. But instead, you know what we done? We bummed over. Went over on a freight on a damn good cold night in the fall. But we got there, and I went to work. I lived on what's called Fifth Avenue. It's above Pittsburgh, 20 miles. They have three towns there, Parnassus, New Kensington and Arnold and Valley Camp. New Kensington is where the American Aluminum Company is. There was thousands of people, actually thousands, standing around at Mellon's aluminum plant. That was the largest aluminum plant in the world, and I suppose as a single plant, probably still is. But they would be there night and day. They would have fires out in the street and where they would form this line. Well, they had a policy, the ones at the head of the line, if he's satisfactory, well, he gets a job. There was one fella that was quite desperate, who somebody told him to go up and talk to a foreman at night when he's home. And this young fella did. He had a wife and two children. Went up and talked to this foreman, and the foreman told him, well, you come down tomorrow and we'll see what we could do. It was more or less a friend who had sent him there, do you see? Somebody that he knew. So the guy goes down in the morning and the foreman came out and looked around and he seen this young fellow standing over there. So he pointed him out and told him to come up there. See, we're going to take him in, give him a job. You know what the workers done? They grabbed the foreman. It's a matter of record there. They tore the man to shreds. I mean, the workers were that desperate because they had a policy among themselves. So, well, you stay in the line. That's your chance. You can't go over and pick somebody else out. They didn't have any union, with the exception of what they had formed among themselves. But those workers were so militant, they tore the foreman to shreds right into the main gate of Andrew Mellon's plant there. Well, there was a number of things that went on all around there, you know. Well, the mines. Now, right above Arnold was the Valley Camp mine. You may have read about the fight at Valley Camp. It was really a fight up there. One fella who had worked there for a number of years, I don't know how many, but anyhow, in these coal companies out there, it was something like up there. The companies always got you in debt, you know, at least when you're working this slack time. They give you credit at the store, and so on and so forth, and in that way they get you to work for a little of nothing. Well, anyhow, this fellow there, he was going to leave, you know, and they had formed a sort of seniority among the workers, while the union, supposed to be union, just wasn't doing anything at all for them. And they put another guy to work that didn't have the seniority. In other words, it was a matter of favoritism, you see. The workers understood that, regardless of what the reason was for it. Nevertheless, they couldn't allow it to exist. And boy, just over this one instance, they shut that mine down. They used every means possible there. They got mine guards, they got state police, plus all the other ones. And do you know that that strike went on for months? They evicted them out of their homes. The guys got a hold of tents. That's one thing that John L. Lewis, mine workers, used to have, was tents all over, you see? And they moved out into these tents. And they had to guard themselves day and night down there, just over that one little issue, you see? I guess in the unemployed movement, I tell you, I worked in the Caterpillar Factory in 1933. The Block 20 strike was in 1932. While that strike and stuff was going on, I didn't work half time. I just couldn't work in the shop and knowing that fight's going on out there. Well, now there's a certain thought that comes into your mind. It's a selfish thought. I mean, their destiny is tied up with mine. I knew damn well the way everything was going on all over the country, that as soon as we're done with this contract, this place is going flat, this contract at the head of the Soviet Union. I'm going to land right into that army of the unemployed. Whatever I can do now is going to help me. I mean, it's a selfish, everybody has a selfish interest, you see. I've seen some awful slaughters, too, that I'm sentimental in a way. I've cried many times right here in Minneapolis that I've showed the unemployed movement. I went into a house. I told you in the beginning, this was right in the beginning of the unemployed movement, when a woman down here on 7th Street, and I think about 16th Avenue there, people come over and notified me in the night about the situation, about this woman crying in there, and the children crying, all of that. And they knew that she didn't have anything to eat. Boy, I went in there, they had a little kerosene lamp burning in there, and I'll tell you, to hear those kids sighing in there, starving to death, and the woman crying. Never went any place to do anything. I mean, she would just completely give up, don't you know?
Mm-hmm.
When I went in there, I had to cry. I just couldn't stand it. It was both felt for them, and I was so mad. I mean, the people actually had to do that with the warehouses bursting with food over here.
Mm-hmm.
And so that night, it just happens that up on 6th Street and 15th or 16th Avenue, there was a little Jewish fellow that run a store there, just a little corner store, but he and I were very friendly. I'd known him, you know. And I went over and I got him out of bed. I told him the situation, and boy, he packed up a big box of milk and real stuff that babies could eat, little children and babies, you know. And he put some bread in, and he did some flour and some baking powder. He himself gathered up this thing. I didn't know they didn't have anything to eat in the house. But anyhow, I had a big grocery box. I took it back in to that woman. I'll tell you, you never saw, you'd have thought somebody gave her $1 million. Actually, she went to work, and boy, she was weak, she was staggering. But boy, I'll tell you, those babies, she seen that they got something to eat. The next day I went up to the welfare board. Didn't have much of organization at then, but it was these struggles that brought organization. And this time I put my own self on the spot. I asked for it. Well, they had to go through all its investigations and so on and so forth. I told them what I had done the night before. Well, there was three of us in the group, what we had done. And, we can't do it, you know. We have this to do and that. And, of course, when are you going to get somebody out? And they wouldn't even commit themselves on that. I said, for Christ's sake, a woman certainly as hungry as they are ain't going to have enough to do them over the day. And I said, I'm not going back to this good person, and because they were just barely living himself. I mean, getting enough out to live. Well, they couldn't do anything, only just the way. I said, okay. I said, I'll do it. I said, you may have me up in jail tomorrow, you see. But I said, them people's going to have something to eat. I'm going to stop to the grocery stores on my way going home. And when they don't, if I can't get anything there for them to eat, I'm going to steal it for them. I said, even if I have to break in a place. I said, them people are going to have food. Jesus, them may get a little excited. I said, that'll be fine, you know. I said, in fact, since I think about it, I said, I think it would be a very good idea. Don't give them anything. Arrest me for breaking in and getting food for these people. Because after all, I know that nobody's going to give you very much. The way business is, and it's all little places. I says, but arrest me for breaking in and get food. I says, I want it that way. It has to get into the papers here in Minneapolis. And I says, then you're going to move. And Jesus, boy, they were down there that afternoon, just like that. We didn't have much of an organization.
No, it wasn't much relief either.
But they didn't like the idea of putting the guy in jail, you know, and then getting up in court and telling about it, because we did have enough organization. And they came through there, the men was holding a meeting, a mass meeting, you know, striking. This was while I was in West Virginia. They came through with an armored car, with machine guns, and they just peppered this camp with women and children sleeping in there in the night, right in the tents. Killed them, I don't know, dozens, at least a dozen, I can't the amount. But we went down, a whole group of us went down there, I guess it was 15 or 20 of us. Then they had a mass meeting that, well, they called, you know, they worked out a strategy there in later years, where they used to call on marches. I mean, they called for marches. That's the only way that you could whip the local mine forces you had to call for outside help. Camp Hill, West Virginia. Did you ever read the record? There's a book on it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very good. I got down there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the workers, they got up. You see, there again, they blocked the food. Mm-hmm. Couldn't get nothing in there. And, of course, they drove the workers all out, and they drove them up onto this hill. But they had made a few charges up there to drive them completely out, you know. But when they, it went on for some time, and they was able to get truckloads of food into them, and they were living up there. But when they finally decided to make this charge on them, you see, then they caught all the truckloads of food, set some of them afire, and others they just poured kerosene all over the whole thing and threw it over the bank. And of course, then they made the statement that there'd be no more food come in. Well, food was mobilized from all over the country. Minneapolis sent quite a bit of stuff down there. And it was shipped down, and it came down to, I don't know if it come to Parkersburg or where it came, by train. And there, of course, then it was picked up by truck. You couldn't get a train to go in there, don't you know? I mean, the railroads wouldn't even carry it, because the railroads and the coal company, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, then they had this organized on a certain day that they're going to bring the food in. And they had called for a march from all over the country. If this march had have ever got there, it's estimated that there would have been 150,000 people. They were coming from as far as Pittsburgh. I mean, they got down every way they could, you know, on freight trains, anyway, cars, trucks, any way they could get there to these points. And of course, they were mobilizing, and then they were going to make a charge right in there to bust up the blockade. But just as they were going to do this, they made a charge up the hill. Well, there was an old preacher there and his son. They were the main leaders. I remember how he prayed. And he'd always been for pacifying everything, you see, but when he actually seen what was happening, why then he became a real fighter. But all they had up there to fight with was rocks. And they had the hill. There was only, you just couldn't climb it every place. There were certain places that you had to come up, you know, to get up the hill. And that's where these police, sheriffs, everything was going to come up there and oust them, you see. And I'll tell you, boy, when they started to come up that hill, the workers had just had this lined with rows and rows, especially with round rocks, you know. And some of them, by God, they pounded rocks for days to make them round so they'd roll. It was good and steep there, you know. And when they just started, they let them charge up. And boy, I'll tell you, when they got up there, they let these rocks go down. You never seen such a, you never seen anything. It actually looked like a landslide.
Oh.
But I'll tell you, they cleaned them out. And at the same time, they came in from the rear on them. They captured the whole damn bunch there. Well, that busted that, whereby, I mean, the governor then had to act, and because these marches, after all, they get a little scared of them things, you see, after, when they see the really mean business. Now, this was done, not with the consent of John L. Lewis, but the only thing, in fact, he did do. He always gave him the tents.
No.
He always gave him tents, cooking utensils and stoves. Yeah, they did. They set up many times. I've seen these camps over there where they did go on for months. And the whole colony, you may say, or whatever it would be, all of the workers that work in that mine, all been evicted out of their houses, then they'd get a place out there someplace, and they would set up these camps, you know. But he never furnished them the food. He furnished them the tents and the stoves and the cooking utensils. And there was a group got around there quite a bit. That was the time we had that big Labor Day blizzard, or Armistice Day blizzard. And somehow, I don't know if that's what saved us or not, but there was a lot of people got there, but the snow was so damn deep they couldn't do anything. The only thing out in front of the house, in a big snowbank, they had, they wrote all kinds of stuff. I mean, they had a guy hanging there, or somebody got a picture in the snow, get out, or this is what's going to happen to you, and so on and so forth. I never paid any attention to it. I don't even know who in the hell done it, some vigilante, but they never come out in the open. Never did bother me after that at all. See, I hadn't been there for very long, but the thing was, we we had a strike there in a steel plant, and they had some government stuff in there. They built steel docks for the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the workers, when they went on strike in the plant, they didn't allow anything to go in or out of that plant, regardless of what the hell it was. And this was supposed to be for some important dock someplace, some important Navy dock. Well, they called us up to the chief of police's office. He wanted to know what the hell we're going to do. And I said, well, it's a strike, that's all. I'm not telling you what we're going to do. We're striking. We're going to try to keep the place closed down. Well, you're going to let the stuff out. Well, I said, I have nothing to say about that. It ain't my stuff. I think the workers would decide on all those. But anyhow, every time they come down to move it out, the workers didn't let them come, you see. So what they do is send the Navy in. By God, they stopped them. Yes, they were. They even stopped the Navy. They chased them away. I don't think them Navy guys even wanted to move it anyhow.
No.
No, I don't think they did. But they went away, and then, of course, this other came out that they were going to raid the house. It came from very good authority.
Is it Eau Claire?
Yeah, it's Eau Claire. So it's a good Union town, you know. If they'd done anything like that, they'd really had hell over there. But anyhow, outside of a gang gathered out there, I didn't raise any excitement or ask for any help. I just thought, well, if they carry it through. But the main thing was I didn't want them to get all of this stuff that I had. I was awful sorry afterwards that I did. Along with it went hundreds of pamphlets and all of my books.
How'd you burn the book?
Was Yehudi Menuhin, and the Dallas Symphony Orchestra was under the direction of Antal Durati in this performance of Béla Bartók's Concerto for Violin and Orchestra, written in 1941.
Here to answer to one thing only.
hit the man. I like my new bed down there at the door.
Oh, I think it's all right.
that you claim to heal the sick.
Thank you. they led you in to din. The Prince of Darkness conceals his evil self and finds refuge in your crying heart.
Thank you. Thank you.